H.G. Wells was a best-selling author in the late 1800s, early 1900s. His works have become movies. Maybe you've seen adaptations, The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, The War of the Worlds. By the end of his life, he was an agnostic at best, if not an atheist. He famously wrote on one occasion these words. He said that religion, or faith, it collapses in the face of calamity. He was convinced that faith collapses in the face of calamity. He once described his view of God this way. He said, the world is like a great stage production, directed and managed by God. As the curtain rises, the set is perfect, to treat for every eye. The characters are resplendent. Everything goes well until the leading man steps on the hem of the leading lady's gown, causing her to trip over a chair, which knocks over a lamp, which pushes a table into a wall, knocking over the scenery, which brings everything down on the heads of the actors. Meanwhile, God is running around, shouting orders, pulling strings, trying to restore order from chaos. But alas, poor God, he is unable to do so. Wells goes on to write that if God existed, he's rather small and limited in his ability to handle the chaos of the world. Well, I want us to enter one of the most chaotic scenes in the New Testament. This is where a prayer meeting morphs into pandemonium. If you're new to our study, we're in the Gospel by Luke. I invite you to turn back to chapter 22. The Lord has only moments ago surrendered to the will of his Father. He is addressing his disciples. We're not told what he's saying, but he no doubt hears the footsteps. He knows that this mob is heading toward the Garden of Gethsemane. Let's pick it up at verse 47. While Jesus was still speaking, there came a crowd of cowards. Well, that's my translation. I have to insert there. And the man called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. So now you have this, beloved. You have the moment arriving. Jesus has long predicted this. One of the 12 is going to betray him. He's about to face the most difficult moments any human being could ever experience. He, fully God, yet fully man. He's about to drink this cup. It's ordained by the counsel of Almighty God. It's been planned before time began. And this cup is one of agony at this moment and a few hours ahead. Now, as we suggested, if you were with us in our last study, last Lord's Day, sports teams celebrate their victory with a cup. You got the World Cup, you got the Stanley Cup, you got the Breeders' Cup, the Davis Cup, and on and on. And it occurred to me that if you're the parents of young children, losing any of those cups isn't nearly as devastating as losing your children's sippy cup. Now, that's the cup that matters. That stops the, Earth's rotation. Those victory cups of those athletic events signify agony, opposition, difficulty, anguish, effort. Likewise, Jesus is calling all of these events, including what we're about to observe, as part of the cup that he's going to drink. He will endure all of it and ultimately defeat all of it. Now, Luke tells us that a crowd arrives. Mark's gospel account says that the crowd comes from the high priests, the elders, the scribes. Luke tells us that the crowd includes them. Look at verse 52. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had come out against him. In other words, they're all in on it. They can't stand waiting to see what's going to happen. Here they are to arrest the Lord around midnight. They're going to try to get rid of him as quickly as they can. And they come, and it strikes me they're prepared for everything except what's about to happen. But here's what they evidently expected. I would observe this, at least one of two responses, if not both. First of all, I believe they expected a measure of deceitfulness. Matthew says that they arrive with torches, lanterns. They light up this garden like noonday. Why? Well, they're assuming these guys are going to run and hide. Jesus maybe withdraws, hides behind a tree. Maybe one of the disciples will say, oh, take me, I'm Jesus, in order to protect him. Or maybe his disciples will say, no, we're all just friends up here for an overnighter. We don't know. But they evidently did expect deception. Because the middle part of verse 47 says, as they planned, Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He drew near to Jesus to kiss him. Jesus said to him, Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? Now, the plan then was for Judas to undeniably identify Jesus with a kiss. A kiss was common in this culture. This could be a kiss on the hand, a kiss on the cheek, both cheeks perhaps, still taking place today in countries in South America where I've traveled. In the church during the first century, a kiss was a sign of friendship, a kiss on the hand, a sign of humility. In fact, by the time of Christ, this had developed into the religious practice of even blowing kisses. It originated when someone would walk past their favorite temple or statue of their god. They would blow it a kiss. They wanted its favor. They wanted a favor from their god. So as they walked by, they made sure they blew it a kiss. To this day, we still use the expression, don't we, of kissing up to someone. That describes somebody who's trying to get a favor on the good side of someone else. As among believers, we know that this kiss is still a traditional greeting in certain parts of the world. The church in Russia takes very seriously the admonition of Paul to greet one another with a holy kiss, Romans 16:16. So they do when the church gathers. Missionary to Russia some time ago invited me to travel with him into some of the less developed areas of Russia, the countryside where the churches were small but deeply united in love, thriving in their fellowship. But he told me that if I came, I needed to be prepared for this tradition where they greeted one another with a kiss on the lips. And I said, wait, you mean the men and the women? And he said, no, just the men. They greet one another with this smack on the lips. He said, Stephen, it's customary. It's quick. They all have thick beards. You won't feel a thing. I never went to Russia. Not because of that, but it just didn't work out for me. Well, it's interesting that Luke kind of glosses over. In fact, you're not even sure that Judas kissed Jesus. You have to go over to Matthew and Mark, where they actually use a compound word that intensifies it, which you could translate shower with kisses, which now makes this all the more despicable, doesn't it? This over-the-top display of affection, false affection. Have you ever thought about, though, what's happening in the spirit world behind the scenes at this moment? You have the serpent embracing the Son. You have a satanically empowered deceiver embracing the deliverer. And Jesus knew it. Now you might wonder why Jesus doesn't perform a miracle and Judas is reduced to a little pile of sawdust. I would have been tempted. How dare Judas kiss the Savior as if he cares about him? He's already sold him for the price of a disabled slave. Betrayal is a terrible thing. But when it comes with a kiss, even more so. When it comes from someone who should love you, when it comes from someone who's supposed to care about you, someone who says they're looking out for what's best for you, that kind of betrayal is especially crushing and discouraging, isn't it? Maybe you're experiencing right now some form of betrayal. Maybe it's a spouse who said they loved you but lived a lie behind you. Maybe it's an adult child who has now discarded you so they could be, quote, free to live their life without your guilt. Maybe it's a coworker you thought had your back, but they really wanted your job. Maybe you feel entitled to a little hatred. A trainload of resentment, maybe revenge. Watch Jesus here. Matthew's gospel says he simply responds by saying, "Friend, do what you came to do." Ken Hughes writes wonderfully in his commentary on this passage, even though Judas was Satan's agent, he was still a lost soul. And Jesus always cared about lost souls. So this was an appeal. This is one last invitation before it was forever too late for Judas. Jesus didn't just preach in his ministry, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. He's living it here. He's practicing everything he preached. So get this scene now. In the midst of this emotionally charged chaos, this mob suddenly appears, torches, lanterns. The Son of God is not panicking. You notice? He isn't running around trying to, you know, get the lamp set back up and get the scenery up and get everything back in order. No, you look at the Son of God here in the midst of this chaos, and he is perfectly composed. Friend, do what you came to do. He's not running. He's not hiding. Now, that leads me to another observation. This mob not only came to the Garden of Gethsemane expecting a measure of deceitfulness, I believe they came, secondly, expecting a measure of defiance. Matthew writes it this way, Judas arrived and with him a great crowd with swords, Machaira, those are the short battle swords of the Roman soldiers, and clubs, those would have been used by the temple police, common among them. John's account records, so Judas, having procured a band of soldiers, a cohort, and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, that's the policemen from the temple, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. This band of soldiers is a battalion of 600 armed Roman soldiers. Officers from the chief priests represented the temple police. They were there to make sure that everything was in order. They carried out the decrees, the verdicts of the Sanhedrin, Israel's Supreme Court. And they all show up here. You got probably 800, 900, maybe 1,000 armed men. Why send an army to arrest a carpenter? Because this is no carpenter. They knew he was no ordinary man. He might pull something supernatural out of his hat, so to speak. Or maybe now that he's cornered, he's going to fight back. So they're ready for anything, but let me tell you, they were ready for nothing that was about to happen. Now, John's gospel fills in for us what happens immediately following Judas's kiss. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" And they answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said to them, "I am he." And when Jesus said to them, "I am he," they fell to the ground. They all, like bowling pins, fall down. Now, it's because in the original language, it's missed by the English here, Jesus simply says, "Ego a me." He says, "I am," all caps. This is the same expression, by the way, God used in giving Moses his name. Moses says, "Who should I, you know, say, send me?" And he says, God says, "Go back to them and tell them my name. My name is I am." The Septuagint translates it, "Ego a me," I am, the verb, Yahweh, Jehovah, Jehovah. Most often translated Lord. So get this, Jesus is announcing to them that the one who spoke to Moses at the burning bush is now standing before them at the Garden of Gethsemane. Ego a me, wham, they fall down. Just one little declaration of his divine nature. And they all did what we all would do in the presence of God. We would fall prostrate. So make no mistake here, beloved. Jesus, the Son of God, is in command. They're not arresting him. He's arresting them. He's gonna help them. He's going to wait, John says, for them to get up. Can you just see those guys, 1,000 of them, getting back up? And then he says again, "Whom do you seek?" "Jesus of Nazareth." "I am." In the Garden of Eden, the first Adam sinned against the will of God. In the Garden of Gethsemane, the second Adam surrendered to the will of God. In the Garden of Eden, the first Adam ran and hid. In his sinful humanity, in the Garden of Gethsemane, the second Adam steps forward and announces his deity. What's happening here is not the decision of the Sanhedrin. It says nothing to do with the Roman soldiers, the temple police, the emperor. This is the decision of the Godhead. Jesus is not a victim. He is a willing sacrifice. Here, let me help you out. You can take me. He's surrendering. Now, evidently, Peter didn't get the memo. It's a little slow on the uptake here. Peter's declaring war. Verse 49. And when those who were around him saw what would follow, they said, "Lord, shall we strike with the sword?" And one of them, evidently not waiting for an answer, struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Well, now you got this set. It's collapsed. I mean, the lamp's crushed. By the way, John's the only gospel writer to give us the details that the servant's name was Malchus. He knew him personally. No doubt, John 18:15 informs us that John knew the high priest. We often overlook the fact that John actually goes with Jesus into the home of the high priest. Peter stands outside. John knew the high priest, more than likely because his relative was Zechariah, a priest, married to Elizabeth, who will bear John the Baptist. Well, all that to say, John knows him. John mentions it's Malchus. Only John does. And only John mentions that Peter was the guy swinging the sword. I can imagine Peter later saying, "John, thanks a lot, you know, for the details you threw into your gospel account." But you have to admit, don't go too quickly, this is great courage. Peter's taking on 1,000 armed men. He's going to jump into it. He deserves, I think, a medal of bravery. He isn't going to live long enough to pin it on his shirt, but he deserves it, unless. Fortunately, Peter's aim was a little off. Malchus should be grateful Peter was a fisherman. But still, imagine this scene. Now you've got a young man, no doubt, screaming in pain. He's holding the side of his head where his ear used to be, gushing blood through his fingers. Soldiers, no doubt, have pulled their swords from their scabbard. They're going to advance forward. Peter's done, and so is everybody else. Now you've got utter pandemonium. You got total chaos. I mean, this all happened so fast. Where did this come from? God the Father must be running around the stage trying to get the scenery back. Now what? Matthew tells us that Jesus said, put your sword back in its place. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? A legion, 6,000 soldiers. Jesus effectively says that all he has to do is ask, and each of the 11 disciples gets 6,000 soldiers, and he's going to get 6,000, extra. Just one request, and 72,000 angels show up. Do you not think I can do that? Luke records Jesus simply saying here in verse 51, no more of this, that is, stop this. Stop. He's commanding everyone. Stop. And he touched his ear and healed him. This is the last recorded miracle of Jesus before he dies on the cross. Don't miss the fact that this miracle was performed on his enemy. Don't miss the miracle either. All four Gospels record that Peter's sword literally severed the servant's ear. Only Luke records that Jesus heals him. He gives us that part. Only Dr. Luke seems to care about the patient and what happened. But follow this. Jesus touched his ear. You could render it, he touched the place of his ear, where it used to be. In other words, Jesus doesn't stoop down and pick up that severed ear and reattach it. He touches the side of Malchus's head, and a new ear appears perfectly whole. The other ear is still on the ground. I know it's kind of gross. Maybe it's still twitching. I don't know, bloody. It's terrible. But, I mean, you got to think about the fact, there it is. There's the ear. Wait, there's the ear. The pain's gone. Screaming stops. Bleeding stops. Listen, Jesus did not perform a medical reattachment. He performed a miraculous recreation. And you have to understand in this context, this was not a random act. Oh, I think I better do a miracle to keep them from, charging. No, this is part of the plan. This is amazing here. It's woven into the Lord's plan from eternity past. Jesus has just announced to this mob that he is the great I Am. He is Yahweh in the flesh, Jehovah, Lord. Only God can create something out of nothing. Well, okay. I'll create something out of nothing. A brand new ear. Many believe that John specifically mentioned the name of Malchus because we learn from early church history that Malchus became a follower of Christ. I could understand why. To the day he died, that was probably his good ear. Now let's again model the heart of Jesus. He had a way of seeing an enemy and seeing a potential disciple. Who do we see? growing list of enemies or a growing list of needy potential disciples? Now, with that, he has a serious warning for these religious leaders. I think he's giving them one more chance of sanity and humility. Verse 52, then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who'd come out against him, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you didn't lay hands on me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. You might circle that word hour and do your own study. I did a very brief one in mine. How the Lord used it. He would say often, this is not my hour. Then in John 17, he says, Father, this is the hour. It's time to be glorified and to glorify you. But he says to them, this is your hour. This is the hour that's going to demonstrate the power of darkness. In other words, this is the hour when hell will do its worst. When the power of darkness seems like, hey man, it's gonna win the day. But just like that cup related to difficulty, but also was transformed into victory. So this hour of hell's dark power is going to eventually become the hour of heaven's great promise. Now let me offer one observation from this scene as it comes to a close. Here it is. Global darkness and personal difficulties that surround you are on a divine timer. Strikes me with the way the Lord uses the word hour. In light of eternity, Jesus says, you get an hour. Which means Satan can do his worst, but it's just a matter of time. And I think now, 2,000 years later, do you think he doesn't hear the ticking of this divine timer? It also informs us that he can't do 1 second more than God allows. Compared to eternity, he's just got 1 hour. Time changes, doesn't it? Our perspective changes the way we view difficulty, betrayal, suffering. The Apostle Paul was beaten, stoned, shipwrecked, abandoned, imprisoned, destined to be beheaded, and yet he would write, for this light momentary affliction. Wait, what? Yeah, for this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. I'm comparing this hour to that hour. Paul wrote to the Romans in chapter 8, for I reckon, I love that, lets me know he was a Southerner, for I reckon here, I've done the computation, I've done the math, I reckon that the sufferings of this present time, oh, they're not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Just wait until that hour dawns. The Apostle Peter had this view as well of the divine timer. He never forgot this event. He writes this, in this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been grieved by various trials for a little while. Now look, Peter suffered for decades until he was finally executed by crucifixion. Just a little while. He learned to compare what was happening today with what will happen on that day. So Jesus is not overwhelmed in the garden. He's in total control of the actors and the set and the stage and the drama and the outcome. In fact, he's written the script. So you can trust him today, in this hour, wherever you are. Let's act and live in a way that proves all those agnostics, atheists, people like H.G. Wells, wrong. Your faith does not need to collapse in the face of calamity. And that's because you know, as we've seen here in the garden, that in the midst of calamity, Jesus Christ, the great I Am, is in total control.